Welcome to Inspiring Stories for Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Hello, my name is Tim McMillan. Welcome to another episode of Inspiring Stories brought to you by Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. My guest in this episode is an absolute legend of AFL, both as a player and as a coach, and we'll go through all of his stats and achievements over the course of the next hour or so. But just quickly, more than 250 games as a player in the VFL, the bulk of those in a golden time at the Hawthorn Football Club. Along the way, he picked up no less than four premierships. He finished his career with the Brisbane Bears. He's then gone on to carve out an incredibly successful time as an AFL coach, not just coaching teams to great success, but instilling a new ethos and a new culture at the clubs that he's been invited to coach at along the way. He is an absolute legend of Tasmania and Tasmanian football as well. So let's meet and hear some of the stories in the inspiring stories of Rodney Rocket Ead. Hello, Rocket. How are you?
Good, thanks, Tim. Thanks very much. Thanks for the intro. Appreciate
it's an absolute that. Pleasure. We've got stacks to get through, Rocket. Can I just, where did the name Rocket first come along and when did it stick? And who calls you Rocket?
When I first went to Hawthorn, obviously just being a young lad, only 18 years of age, and a guy called Peter Welsh, who was probably one of the characters at Hawthorn, ended up going to Richmond, playing a premiership for Richmond in 1980, gave me the name Rocket. And I think at that stage there was a cartoon character, Rod Rocket, but a lot of the Rods, like Rod Laver and Rod Carter and a few others, were called Rocket Rod. And it stuck, some people say, because I had some pace, but that's where it originated from, and then it stuck. I mean, some of the nicknames that some guys have got, you wouldn't want, but I was very happy with that. And most people do actually call me that, even females.
Yeah.
Friends and that sort of thing. But that's okay. I certainly like it.
Let's go right back to the very beginning. Growing up in Tasmania, a football-loving state, when did you first fall in love with the game?
My dad was always heavily involved in footy.
Yeah.
I'm the Tasmanian Hall of Fame. He's a member of that as well what he's done, football playing and then coaching amateur teams and then being in administration. So my first real thought was, or memory, was actually playing at school. My dad was involved. When I was really young, my dad had finished playing young because of knees. And it was probably really the first memory I've got is 1966 grand final. Yeah. And I barracked for Collingwood because I came from a suburb, a team called Glenorchy, which was black and white. Collingwood being black and white, working class suburb. So and I remember that and then making a primary school representative side. So that's my first memory, really. And then after that, following Glenorchy and my dad's team in the Amateurs University, coached the university students, which was always an eye-opener as well. So that was early days. Yeah.
And am I right in remembering that you were lucky enough to play with Peter Hudson as a youngster in Tassie?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I played, obviously, school footy, then went to Glenorchy underage. Their Colts is in WA, so they were under 18s, not under 19s.
Yeah.
And then the next year when I progressed, thinking going to play reserves, was Peter's first year as captain coach at Glenorchy. So I played, that was 1975, and I played the bulk of that year in the seniors, fortunately, and we won what was called the state premiership. Went to Adelaide to play in the Premier's Carnival. So there was West Perth from Perth and Norwood and North Melbourne. So that was my one and only year of senior footy in Hobart, and played under Peter and still friendly with Peter now.
Yeah.
Because fortunately I got his number when I went to Hawthorn the next year.
Yeah. What a guy to have guiding you at that stage of your career.
Yeah. He's a lovely person, very humble superstar and legend.
Yeah.
Quite tough as a coach, though. So it's he used to train us hard.
Yeah.
We've had some reunions and people still bring up about there's a hill at a place called Claremont, which is where the Cadbury's factory was. And overlooked the river and he found a hill and we called it Spiel Hill. And there's still hot afternoons and run down the hill and up we go. And a few blokes had big lunches and things like that. So that always comes up in conversation. But he certainly got us fit. He certainly did really well in his first year as a coach. And then he came back and played halfway through that year. He was still tied to Hawthorn and played, probably got a clearance just before the June cutoff and had a really good end of the season himself.
Who was tougher then, you or him, as a coach?
Oh, Peter was tougher. He trained you harder. There's no doubt about that. So, he was good. He was terrific. Just what we needed at the time, even though I was young. The group responded really well to it.
Glen Orchy, for those who may not have heard of it and think it might sound like a nice single malt whiskey, what happens in Glen Orchy, Tasmania? Because that's obviously the place that you left as a fairly young man to head to the big smoke of Melbourne.
A lot of success as a football club, which was originally called Newtown. But AFL players, Darryl Sutton, played with Darryl in 75. Trevor Sprigg, who's obviously East Fremantle boy and was at West Coast as chairman of selectors. Trevor had coached before Peter got the job. He was captain coach, Trevor, for 4 years. And then Trevor stayed on and played at centre back, won the medal for the best player in the competition that year in 75. It's a working class suburb. It's now a city, just north of Hobart, produced some really good players that have played AFL, Andy Lovell, Adrian Fletcher. So those type of players, obviously Darren Creswell as well. So we've had a list of probably another half a dozen or so as well. But, it's had a long history of success. I think they're going through a bit of a battle at the moment. But, it's a great place to grow up. It's a great sporting town. So very fond memories of the time there.
As a proud Tasmanian, Rocket, are you surprised, disappointed that you don't still have a dedicated Tasmanian team in the comp?
Oh, both. Both surprised, really. But the AFL and their wisdom went the other way, developing non-football areas, which I can understand to a degree, but Tasmania's been heartland football. So you look at Perth, Western Australia, South Australia, Victoria and Tasmania have really been heartland. The players that have come out of Tasmania per capita really are such a small population. And the big four have always Hudson, Hart, Stewart, Baldock, probably they always say that Darryl's probably the best of them, but those four are the big four, and Croswell, and you've got Matthew Richardson and Lynch, and there's been some great players come out of Tassie that it's on the wane, and you hear stories that not only the big clubs, as in the statewide comp, but country clubs are folding and struggling to get numbers, and the juniors are going to other pursuits, and whether that be off-field as well. So it's a real troubling time, and I think I'm more not as fazed about not having a team in the main league, which I think would be great for Tasmania, but I think that'll help the development and the pathways and all the structure underneath. And I think that's been dismantled a fair bit because of lack of care and interest, I think, from the AFL to a degree, to be honest, and funding. And I don't think they've modelled it really well. And I think having a national team or a team in the AFL is not going to fix all ills, but we can capitalise out of the state and develop pathways and better coaching and give the kids, be aspirational.
So it becomes a centre of gravity in Tasmania, doesn't it?
They can get their own local club to survive, and town, as we know, country towns and that survive on their football and netball. And I think we can do that better.
Let's go back to 1975 then. You're still a teenager, plucked from Tasmania to go and head to Hawthorn. What are your memories of being recruited as a, 17-year-old?
So 75, played in the state premiership for Glen Orchy. Then at the end of that, I remember John Kennedy coming and speaking to me in the carnival in Adelaide when we were about to play Norwood. And I got friendly enough with John in my time, but he's quite a scary man and doesn't give much away, and that booming voice that he's got, and there's a bit of intimidation with it. Said they'd like me to go to Hawthorn next year, which only AFL or VFL club that spoke to me. North apparently come and watched me play one day through Darryl Sutton, but I didn't play very well, so they never spoke to me. And so I was thrilled to get invited. Had a bit of a cricket career at that stage. Had to really make a choice, I suppose. I was about to go to England and play in the leagues over there. And So I decided to go to Melbourne. I think I'll be back in Hobart within 2 years. So I went to Hawthorn and played the under-19 cricket carnival. I think it was in Perth that year we played, actually.
Yeah, right.
Went to Perth and played. So Jeff Marsh was playing. We had Bernie playing, Dirk Wellen and a few others in that that carnival. And then that was in the January. Then when I got back 2 weeks later, I was going to Melbourne for football.
Yeah.
So went to, did year 12 there, boarded with the family. Had to get a, it's interesting today with young players, oh, I don't want to be drafted into state, want to stay home with mum, all these sorts of things. And go there, and I had to get a bus and then another bus to school from home, and then get a bus to the train station, catch a train to Glenfree Oval. So there was no one picking you up, and silver services young players get today, and they get looked after really well.
And
so that, you know, going through that, and Hawthorn, I think, were one of the better clubs as far as the welfare issue side and what they make you feel. But I had to do that and get a ride home after training. I remember Brian Cook, who's the CEO, was CEO of the Eagles and CEO now of Geelong. He played at Hawthorn in my first year. So he used to give me a drive home, a ride home in his FC light blue Holden. That was at the gear stick. And so I, every time I see Cookie, I keep reminding him of our times together. And so it was, but yeah, I didn't get a game till round 16, I think. And looking back, I mean, they won a, we won a premiership that year. And looking back, perhaps lucky I had that drive, because looking back, I was probably lucky to be involved. To, you know, you'd think young kids serve their apprenticeship, and I was probably in a hurry. And fortunately, they tried a lot of players on a wing. I got game in round 16 and didn't do that well early, and then had a good game, I think, about my third game, and was able to stay in for the premiership. So I didn't do a lot, but I feel very fortunate to be involved in it.
But look, you got, you had another three goes at tasting that success. We need to take a break, but we'll get into that right after we hear these announcements. This is Inspiring Stories. Rodney Rocket Ead is our special guest. Back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. AFL legend Rodney Rocket Ead is our special guest. We've just been speaking about your first premiership, one of four that you won with the Hawks, Rocket, in 1976. 77, no success in that year, but it wasn't long after that that you got another chance at winning a grand final. 1978, the second of your four premierships. You're a little older, a little wiser, a few more games under your belt there. What do you remember of that season and that grand final?
Yeah, it's interesting. Just go back a year.
We
played the premiership in 76 and John Kennedy coach. You talk about succession plans, and you talk about now the Mitchell and Clarkson thing. It's obviously come a bit messy. John Kennedy, I think it was the January in pre-season, walked up to David Parkin, who was assistant coach, and said, said you're going to be coach. And so he resigned, and David took over the reins. And generally, he was a bit shocked. David tells me the story as well about there was no sort of planning. It's like, you know, you're lumped with the job. With the job. So John resigned, and David took the reins. And in 77, we're probably unlucky, really. North deserved to win, but we just lost to Collingwood in the second semi. It's one Carmen knocked out Tucky behind play, or just in play a bit. And we missed a couple of shots. So we could have won that game and then be into the grand final. Then Collingwood North would play the prelim. So, and then we got belted the next week. We North slaughtered us. So it was a bit of an empty feeling. Even though I was young, it was a bit of an empty feeling. You could see the guys were really smarting from that. They'd lost in 75 and now didn't make it in 77. And then 78 under David was a real focus year. We became pretty focused, and we played really good footy, what I can remember. And as you said, a little bit wiser. I was only 20, but still was able to enjoy the occasion, played a bit better, played okay. We had the run on. Now, we kicked inaccurately, but we Knightsy sort of cut up a bit in the last quarter, got knocked out, I think, but then went forward and kicked a couple of big goals. So it was a great win. You know, we had a great rivalry with North Melbourne, so that was, we played North again. yeah, it was an exciting time.
Yeah. We haven't got to the part of your career yet, Rocket, you know, your coaching time, but looking back on those incredible years at Hawthorn, you're obviously starting to absorb strategy and all these, you know, teachings about what makes a club so successful. As you reflect on that, who were the people that really had an impact on you when you were still a player, but from a coaching and just club setup level that you ultimately learned so much from?
Yeah, I think I was very fortunate to have the three coaches I had. I had John for 12 months. And I have some funny stories about John. I was like relaying when I anecdotally about his toughness, and like he's a rare intelligent man. He'd quote Karl Marx and Shakespeare, and most of it go over to his head. He wouldn't know what he was talking about. But he's a white collar worker, but he was a blue singlet coach. It was all about toughness and mental toughness and push through the barrier and all those sorts of things. But he was a very intelligent man. So he's intriguing. He was an intriguing individual. And then David Parkin, who's obviously coached four premierships, most self-effacing man I've met. He really is quite humble and criticises himself, I suppose, and he doesn't need to be. He was a great coach and obviously had great success, coach of premiership at Hawthorn and great success at Carlton. And then had Jeansy, who, like John, and all three really were great orators. John Kennedy's the best speaker I've heard.
Yeah.
Jeansy was great to be able to do it. And David is a great speaker. If you hear David publicly speak, he's enormous. So they all scared me in many ways to become a coach. And I said to myself, I'm not going to become a coach. So David was the one that introduced what he called in retrospect, but really a review process, give you a lot of written, typed out sheets of team and individual. I spent a lot of time. His work ethic was enormous. And I used to throw them away to my great regret, and because I didn't want to coach. Some players would say, oh, you're a coach, because I used to think about football a lot and why and wherefores and why are we doing things and can we do things better. And so when I went to Brisbane, I was really thrown into the deep end at the seconds level, which I didn't want to do. I pushed back because there was ownership problems. Scase had gone, and then Reuben Pillerman took over. The coach went, Knightsy got sacked, and then Paul Feltham got the sack after 6 weeks or 8 weeks. Then Normie Dare took over, who was the assistant coach. They had no money. They couldn't recruit new players. It was a really tough time, and the reserves were playing in the VFL, AFL reserves competition, so you'd fly with your team. And he said, oh, I'd like you to coach. I said, no, I don't want to do it. And then he asked Mark Williams as well, Choco Williams. And so we were going to share it. He forced me really into it. And then the board said, no, only one of you can do it. So Choco dropped out straight away, and I'm left with it. I was still playing senior football. So it's archaic, really, in an elite competition. I was coaching till three-quarter time of the reserves and then go down to prepare for senior football. So that was really, in many ways, forced upon me. Norm sort of pushed me into that. I didn't really want to do it, but I loved it. I really enjoyed it. As sliding door moment, that's a sliding door moment. Another one, I got injured with my knee, did an MCL about round 4 or 5. So I had 10 weeks off, which just I just coached. And then when I came back, I was technically captain coach, I suppose, of the twos. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
And played the last game of the seniors as a farewell game, if you want to say that, out of the Western Oval. And, so I was sort of tipped in the deep end in many ways and really loved it. But you talk about people influence. It's I found my first 6 weeks of coaching that I was trying to do what John or David or Alan, what would they would say at this particular moment. Then I realised you've got to be yourself. So that's one advice I always give coaches. Coach your own personality. Don't try and be something you're not. And don't if you're quiet and you're pensive or you're a bit animated and you coach to what you are, because players want to see
just honesty, authenticity,
integrity about that. Authenticity. So I did that, and then it was more educative and thoughts on the game. And looking back to it, even when I went to North Melbourne a few years later with Dennis and then my own and then going to the Swans, football tactics and strategy were pretty basic. We all did this, every team did the same thing. So I think the way I was thinking, I got a bit of a jump on a lot. You're prepared to try things and invent things, and we had the flood in Sydney at the time, but there are other different things, what you do with tag players, a whole range of different setup and your positions. that nothing had been done like that. It was all about, well, you, I suppose Barassi and Sheeds were a little bit early where they'd change a fullback to full forward or have a spare man in defence, which wasn't done before. So anything new at that stage sort of tend to have an effect. But I must admit, I really enjoyed my time coaching the Brisbane Bears reserves.
Yeah, which was your first sort of big foray in, as you mentioned. But just before we wrap up your playing time, and get stuck into your coaching. The other grand finals that you were lucky enough to play in, which do you reckon was your best? I mean, people talk about the, I think the 86, where you were largely sort of teamed up with Carlton legend Craig Bradley there and managed to silence him for most of the game. Was that your best grand final you played, do you reckon?
That's the best one I've played.
Yeah.
And probably as rewarding because I got dropped for the 85 grand final.
Yep.
After getting votes in the media and votes in the best and fairest in the preliminary final. So I was one of the better players in the best six and got dropped. So when players used to kind of whinge at me about getting dropped for a game, I said, I thought to myself,
no, bugger off
pretty quick. So, yeah, that was a tough time. And then got dropped a couple of times during 86. And then lucky enough, I got dropped, I think, just for the first final. Against Carlton, and Carlton belted Hawthorn. And I think Gingy was a great coach, but he wasn't great tactically and got outsmarted a bit by Robert Wall. So I got in the next week against Fitzroy and did well against Nick Conlon, and then on a halfback flank. And then the next week, Gingy went one-on-one. He didn't want to get messed up again what had happened in the second semi. So I was up against Craig Bradley and other players had certain players, and no matter where they played, you went with them. And and that was certainly my best game.
Yeah.
I think I lost to Norm Smith by a vote. And it was a rewarding to play well in the grand final and help, but it was also rewarding to bounce back from the hurdles we'd faced.
Yeah. Going from such a successful and prestigious and well-established club like Hawthorn then to the Brisbane Bears, what sort of a culture shock was that for you? I know you were sort of getting towards the end of your playing career, but going from that setup to what was, you know, a pretty new venture at that stage with the Brisbane Bears, what was it like?
Yeah. Well, it's exactly what you imagine like. And you look at the VFL, you look at the age of now what they've done for the Suns and the Giants compared to what they did for the Brisbane Bears or back in those days was horrendous, really. But there was no change room, so you changed in portables. People running the club didn't know much about footy, if anything. The recruiting was bad, not so much from the Bears' point of view, from what they did, but the AFL, what they gave for allowances to recruit players. Everyone had to give up two players. Carlton gave up Aitken, who was, I think, from Perth originally, but he said he was already become a doctor in England. So that he was the one. So there was these circumstances which were really harsh. So Knightsey was given a real, not a poison chalice because it hadn't started, but a real tough assignment. And they won their first two games. It was the year before I went there. I went the second year with Roger Merrick, Scott McIver and Rod Lester-Smith. And their first year, they won their first two games, one at Geelong. And they did a fantastic job, but they're always going to run out of puff because of the recruiting and the circumstances. And I think he did a really good job. But people like Scase and other people involved wanted success straight away weren't. And you even find that in AFL footy now, where people who do know, they get emotional about where they're at and where clubs are at and where they should be. And so I think Pete was pretty harsh and done by, to be honest. I think he was it was a tough job, tough assignment, and they had no help from head office. So that was always tough. It was always better for them when they went to. And then Wolsey came in, and that was Norm, and then Wolsey. And then that was my last year when I coached the reserves. He won the flag at Waverley when the Eagles played Hawthorn. Rob just by halfway said, oh, we just got to play the kids. So their results went down a little bit, but you could see the plan he put into place was play the kids, let's draft better. And they drafted after I'd left, Vossi and Chris Scott and Lepich, and they went there and then
off they
recruited
went.
Well.
Yeah.
And they got the finals in 95, I think, lost the first final to Carlton, only by 10 points, the closest anyone got to Carlton. And so he'd set the club up really in a good fashion.
Yeah.
So and they were back to Brisbane, which is obviously a bigger town, a bigger city. And then, so as they are now, the Brisbane Lions, and now in the merger with the Bears and Fitzroy.
Just before we go to another break, Rocket, any memories you can share of encounters with the infamous Christopher Skase?
No, real, spoke to Christopher probably twice and just a hello, how are you going? That was about it.
That's so, about it.
Hardly saw him.
No postcards from Mallorca later on?
No, nothing like that. There was a fair bit of money spent in certain areas that we used to talk about, say, well, we haven't got a gym, we haven't got change rooms, but you fly up the lunches from Melbourne, from Peter Rowland, who's one of the better catering ones in Melbourne, and that was for the president's lunch. That was the food from Melbourne. So it'd fly it up. Like, yeah, there was a bit of opulence in the wrong areas, I think. But, they got their act together and now the Lions, won the three flags and did all that. So now it's part of the history.
Very good. We need to take a break, Rocket. So we'll get more into your coaching career right after this. This is Inspiring Stories. Rodney Ead is our special guest. Back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bower and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bower and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Tim McMillan is my name. My special guest in this episode is Rocket Rodney Ead. Rodney, you mentioned that you kind of fell into coaching post your playing days at Brisbane. You obviously loved it. You tasted some success at reserve level with Brisbane and then with North Melbourne after that. Making the change up then to senior level probably seemed like an inevitability, wouldn't it? You would have been in hot demand at that point of your coaching career.
I don't know about hot demand. I went for the Hawthorn job the year before when Knightsy got the job. Might have been the year before that. Was sort of Wayne Schimmelbusch, I just even before that, but had been sacked at North, that I was asked to present for that. Now, it's interesting, Dennis Pagan says that he was a rank outsider, but Dennis was the favourite because he knew, the board members knew him. I was really young and wet behind the ears. And he said that I was more of a favourite to him, as in the betting, but it's not the case. I really hadn't prepared any much for it, hadn't thought about senior coaching at that stage. I thought it was still learning. Did a presentation for the board, which I had 10 pages. Dennis had 60, I think. so I was fortunate in many ways because when it was done, that Dennis took over in the February. And he said to me once, just in passing, he said, if I'd got the job in November, you wouldn't be here. And I said, I thought that'd be the case because you have your own people. So Dennis and I worked together okay. I learned a lot. And so I had 3 seasons under Dennis before I fortunate to land the Sydney job and had been interviewed for Brisbane and for Fitzroy at that stage. And I thought Sydney was the least chance out of those three and ended up landing the Sydney job, which was, in hindsight, was very fortuitous. And I was very pleased I did.
Was that, you said least likely that you thought, but most attractive at the same time?
Oh, no, I hadn't thought of that. I think I'd put in my mind that because I'd been to Brisbane and some people there were positive about me and Fitzroy had spoken in positive terms as well. So I thought, well, maybe that is a really good chance. But you knew they were on their knees. It was always going to be a tough gig if you went to Fitzroy. But I thought Brisbane and then the John Northey, Robert Walls, because Wallsey was finishing, that sort of got in train at the last minute. But Sydney went through a fairly extensive process, had 3 interviews. It's a funny story. My wife and I have been married before, so I had kids, so a blended family. They were showing us my second interview, a third interview, and I went to Sydney, took my wife up. We went to the hotel one night, I said, I think I'm going to get this job, which was a surprise. I thought, that's sort of showing me around too much. And she said, you got to promise me, I can't come. I can't bring the kids, her kids are a certain age from school. And I said, no. She had a few tears in her eyes. And I asked the footy manager, can you just take us to the airport? And he said, oh, you want to meet Kelvin Templeton? I said, Kelvin wants to meet you. I said, no, go home. So I got on the plane and he was going to offer me the job. And so I, on the plane, my wife's got tears and she said, "You promise, you know, we won't take." I said, I promise you we won't take the job. She got back to the airport. I said, "I'll get the car from long-term car park." On the way, I got a call from Kelvin and he said, I'd like to offer you the job. I said, "Yeah, no worries. Fine, I'm in." So I got the car, got back and said, "Darling, got some bad news for you.
You better sit down.
The Sydney job." So anyway,
how did that go? And
oh no, she was fine. She was very supportive. So it was just her to get around with family, and she had, you know, teenage kids, and we worked it through. And for her first 3 months in Sydney, I think she cried every day and couldn't get out. Then actually, when we had to leave Sydney to come back to Melbourne, she didn't want to leave. She was she loved it. So enjoyed the lifestyle and the people. So anyway, it's funny how things happen. But yeah, so but to answer your question, I know I didn't think Sydney was really on the radar. I thought they were going through a process, but ended up getting it.
And stayed there for a while, 96 through until 2002.
So coached then, actually stayed another couple of years. I was a family member sick with cancer, so which was not great for career-wise or employment. So stayed in Sydney for another couple of years to help the family member through and Emma, all the family through this illness. So so end of 2002, I finished the coaching at Sydney.
And then from there, of course, to another famous stint at the Western Bulldogs. How did that come about, and was it an easy decision to head back to Melbourne?
Yes, it was an easy decision. I knew I had to go back to Melbourne, either coaching or for employment. It was tough in Sydney at that stage. But I had an interview process at Adelaide and Richmond. I didn't think I'd get Richmond, and there was another. Oh, Hawthorn was the other one. It's interesting now. People saying Dunstall hasn't refuted it at all. It's nice of Jason that Clarkson beat ex-Hawthorn people in the interview process. I accepted the Bulldogs job before I was interviewed with Hawthorn. I never got interviewed at Hawthorn. So technically he didn't beat me. It was the right decision to go
to
with.
Just to set the record straight.
Dermot came and saw me in Sydney and said, "Oh, they're going through this process. It'll start the end of next week." And I said, "Well, be honest, the Bulldogs have already spoken to me and had a chat on the phone with Jose Romero, who was on the board."
Yeah.
And I said, "They sound reasonably positive, just the way I'm reading it." And I said, "I'm going for an interview on the weekend." And he said, "Oh, can you put them off?" That I said, "No." But I said, "If they tick the boxes that I'm going to ask them about, if and they offer me the job, I'm going to take it. I'm not going to play one off against the other or see if I can get a club with supposedly more money or whatever the case may be." She said, "Oh, okay, well, we'll fast track. We'll get the interview on the Monday." So that way. So Dermot had organised this interview on the Monday. I think Dunstall was at a CEO's conference in the weekend somewhere. So I think it might have been a Saturday, might have been a Sunday, I think. I got interviewed in Melbourne at some office away from, anyway, somehow some media found out about it.
Yeah.
And they always Robert do. Wall's on the interview panel, and there's a couple of Jose and a couple of others. And then at the end of it, they said, "Oh, will you sit in the other room for a while?" I said, "Oh, yeah, okay." And they offered me the job. So I phoned my manager. He came in, and they said to Ricky Nixon that we don't want him to leave the building until he accepts. So I accepted, and then I had to phone. At that stage, Collingwood had spoke to me about helping them with some company. You know, Mick was coach. It was not so much helping Mick. It was helping develop other coaches and other things. So I had to phone Eddie. And then I had to phone Dunstall, and Dunstall's phone was engaged or off because he was at a meeting at this meeting. Never phoned me back, never returned his call. Said thanks, and thanks for letting me know. It was typical Jason. So I had to let Hawthorn know, and there's someone else I had to phone and say, "No, I've accepted the Bulldogs job." And that's what it was. So I accepted on the Sunday, so I didn't even go for an interview with Hawthorn. And then they went through a process, I think, for another 2 or 3 weeks before they appointed Alistair.
Yeah, there you go. We'll get into your successes at the Western Bulldogs right after we take another break, Rocket, and I'll get you to reflect on your time there and some of your other encounters with the AFL media as well, which is a whole beast in itself, isn't it? This is Inspiring Stories. Rocket Rodney Ead is my special guest. Back with more right after this.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything. Inspiring stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Rocket, Rodney Ead is my special guest in this episode. Rocket, your time at the Western Bulldogs, you had some really colourful characters there, didn't you? I suppose people might describe your own style of coaching as, you know, you're fairly forthright. Some might say, you know, tough and uncompromising. How did you go managing some of the big personalities that were stars in your side there at the Western Bulldogs?
Yeah, well, even Sydney had Tony Lockett and a few others, well, Derek Kickett. Yeah, I think that persona sometimes is not what was inside the four walls. Certainly during the 2 hours in the box, even in the box, I wasn't like that in the room. So it tends to get blown out a bit, but anyone would live with that. It had relationships with those guys. They're fine. I mean, there's always a public relationship, you say, with Brian Lake, say. Brian was an extremely good player and a very funny guy, which I enjoyed humour. Just Brian was a bit frustrating and he needed a cattle prod every now and then to be able to play. It was, it's an interesting one story about him because he always wanted to come to me and say, I want to play full forward. And I said, no, you know what? No, Brian, you got to play fullback. Okay. Because Brian didn't do what you asked him. He always did something different. Yeah. That's fine. And we were playing the Eagles one day in Perth and physio phones me in the morning of the game and said, Brian's had a back spasm. He can't play. I went, okay. I said, you tell Brian, if he can get himself right, I'll play him full forward. Sure enough, Brian's right.
It's a miracle.
Put him out full forward. After 10 minutes, put him to full back and play the rest of the game at full back. So he is an interesting character, but I really enjoyed coaching Brian. He was a terrific player. I'm glad he got the premierships at Hawthorn. He's a really good player for them. He won Best and Fairest with us and was all Australian, the Bulldog team. He was really good for him. He was
an absolute champion.
Brad Johnson was a star. And I was fortunate when I went there that the five oldest players were so professional and terrific human. Chris Grant was a star. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd had Chris for another 3 or 4 years. Luke Darcy, unfortunately, I made him captain and then hurt his knee a couple of times. I didn't get a lot of games out of Luke, but such a strong leader and obviously a great player before I got there, but unfortunately we didn't see he couldn't carry that on with the injuries he had, but very professional. Brad Johnson, a star, and became captain after Luke. And just this determination and ability that he had, it was terrific. Rowan Smith, only had a couple of years. Rowan, he retired, but just so professional as well. And Scott West, you know, he's won a lot of Best and Fairest, but they're all different characters, but I was very fortunate to have a really young group of those five guys be able to set standards and set the bar up to what's expected. And they're all, they all went about it different ways. Luke was quite forthright and strong and Brad was more talkative and others just do it different ways, but they were fantastic. So I was very fortunate to go there. I didn't know a lot about the group when I went there. They were quite young and I didn't know a lot about, but they really embraced trying to improve and wanted to get better. And so I was very fortunate to go. I really enjoyed my time at the Bulldogs, probably as much as take the premierships out, probably as much as anywhere else I've enjoyed my football.
Yeah.
It was a great club to be involved with and, it's great they're having success at the moment.
Yeah, and of course, some great success while you were there, success that they hadn't really tasted for some time. Sorry, we're having to skip through fairly quickly here, Rod. There's so much of your story to cover. You have, crossed to the dark side a little bit and had a bit of a bit of time in the media as well, sort of post-coaching. How do you see the AFL media? And I ask that because, you know, the elephant in the room, there's obviously that famous clip of you that went viral that was very, you know, shall we say, craftily edited, a famous spray directed towards Will Minton.
Because Will didn't even know about it because it was in the box. So it's not even a spray to the player. So that's what I'm saying. I say things in the box knowing that the players don't know what's happening. So, that was poor.
Yeah.
And I think I know where it's come from. And I think the AFL were poor because it's come out of AFL media as well. That's how it's got out.
Yeah.
And they didn't talk about it. So, as I said, that's over a full game and they put it into a minute and a half. So, that was poor. I think basically the media are okay. They do their job. They've got a job to do. I think today where media's changed so much is social media.
Mm.
And so much clickbait and it's anything to get a headline and it's there's so many media outlets and so many ways of communicating that someone would say or do something to get a headline.
Yes.
That's why, you know, they say, oh, we don't want to create robots with players and coaches, but that's why you do, because you get burnt by the media.
Absolutely.
So then for one person will spoil it for everybody, and therefore you don't trust them. So, but generally I think the media do a good job. You just got to know that they're just doing their job.
Just don't trust them. What's in the future then for you, Rocket? What's left on your bucket list still to do in a professional capacity at least?
Now retire. That's on my bucket list. I've got a few things going at the moment. Had a couple of nibbles and bites about being involved in AFL clubs.
Yeah.
So that's always going to be difficult now with the soft cap and now COVID and money and that sort of thing. There was spent it somewhere else. But at the time, I didn't want to do things part-time. That was okay. I've helped some people along the way. But I've got a bit on at the moment. I'm coaching a local team, which is fine. I'm director of coaching at Scotch College, one of the private schools here in Melbourne.
Yep.
Working for a charity, not-for-profit organisation called the Fathering Project, which started in Perth, actually.
Yeah, which we know well here. Yep.
Yes, Dr. Bruce Robinson. So I started an ambassador and then be able to help them now and working for them. So that's really enjoyable. Then doing a couple of other little things as well, some speaking, public speaking, that sort of stuff. So I've got a bit on my plate, but
keep it very
looking
busy.
Forward to retirement in the next couple of years.
Good to hear. Well, look, we'll let you go. Thank you so much for sharing your story. There's been so much to get through. So apologies for glossing over some of your other highlights and achievements over the years, but just too many to get through in an hour. But thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thank you. You've been listening to Inspiring Stories, this one, with the one and only Rocket Rodney Ead here on 882 6PR. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. We look forward to you joining us again next time as we unearth another inspiring story.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.